coming up next on 94.7 WTVC LP Charlottesville. It's Apropos of Something, co-hosted by Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence. Apropos of Something welcomes experts, activists, and the marginalized from our community to discuss how the latest policies are affecting everyday people. Apropos of Something is brought to you by the Beckham team at Keller Williams. And now, here's Ellen.
Good morning. Welcome to Apropos of Something. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville Resistance Radio. Apropos of Something airs live every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence from our studio in New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts, and we guarantee every show will be apropos of something. Today, we're cashing in on the expertise of cryptocurrency guru Matt Rohde. Frankly, like many, we've been confused by crypto, Bitcoin and blockchain. Fortunately for all of us, we've got Matt to break it all down. Matt also happens to own the organic donut business Carpe Donut, and he's created Donut Coin, a donut-backed currency. Dollars to donuts. We'll find out all about that in just a few minutes. Sorry, I couldn't help that. And we're talking about the very specific effects the Trump administration's policies are having on children and families separated at the border with Professor of Psychology Jim Cohn. Jim has been researching this crisis for these children through his podcast, Circle of Willis. We'll talk about his recent Washington Post op-ed on the subject entitled, "The Trump Administration is Committing Violence Against Children." Cohn also has a new project to help reunite families. We'll find out details and what we can do to help. In just 1 year and a half, we on this program have spoken to over 100 talented, scholarly, fascinating guests like these about everything from the rise of fascism to the life of bees, from Black Twitter to the refugee crisis, from soul food to how to make a balanced cocktail, and so much more. Check out all our podcasts. You can download them at 947wpvc.org. And my friend, my good friend Nancy Lawrence, are you there?
Ellen, I am here. I am totally here. It has taken this long for us to finally chat during a segment about donuts. I mean, come on.
And you know what? Matt brought some donuts for us, so that was really sweet. You did. Sorry you can't partake.
Well, that's fine. You know, anything, any distraction from the unbearable lightness of heaviness that is every second of every day. That is why I'm focusing on the donuts of all the things that you said.
Yes. And also, another good thing was the landslide primary victory in your city, New York. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez beat Joe Crowley in the 14th District, which contains parts of Queens and the Bronx, which you and I are very familiar with. And that was the biggest upset since 2014, when a guy named David Bratt defeated Eric Cantor.
Yes, I dig those, even though I want the midterms to get here already. I dig all these surprise waves that we hear of along the way. I just I can't stress enough. I would forego summer for November right tomorrow. But that was amazing. As was the surprise of, I don't know if you caught any of it, but just seeing Rod Rosenstein be such a hero in front of his own party, in front of the GOP, when they were grilling him about doing his job. I mean, truly, to me, that was like a guy going high, as they say, and still packing a punch. So that, too, was just as much a surprise as Miss Ocasio.
Yeah, and just back to her, just to emphasize,
yes,
she was outspent by 18-1 margin. And I love what she said, that this is a race about people versus money and about working hard, what we all need to do. Like we always say, we just need to do one more thing to bring about a change in this regime. She said, "I cannot believe these numbers right now, but I do know that every person here worked their butt off to change the future of the Bronx and Queens. This victory belongs to every single grassroots organizer, every working parent, every mom, every member of the LGBT community. Every single person is responsible for this." I love that.
It'll be exciting. Yeah. Well, I don't want to jinx it because I know it's anyway. But anyway, yeah, it's very good news. I'm sticking with that. It's amazing news. I'm all for her success. Makes me wonder if there was ever a time when when candidates just being super boring, you know, was what we expected, as opposed to what we're living in now, where they're either quite admirable or quite crazy. It's quite a contrast.
And I know you wanted to mention something about the Supreme Court.
Well, yes, I did. That there is something there's much we can all do, but in terms of the stuff you can do while you're at home or anyway, is call, even if you don't live in Alaska, Maine, North Dakota, West Virginia, or Indiana, call the Senate number, which is 202-224-3121. Call Lisa Murkowski, Senator Susan Collins, Heidi Heitkamp, Joe Manchin, Joe Donnelly, and tell them that no one should be putting out a nominee while they're under criminal investigation for colluding with a foreign adversary. Even as much as I'm all for the rationale of McConnell, you know, in 9 months wouldn't, I know, advance Merrick Garland, which is a worthy rationale as well. But just even aside from that one is the fact that this president is under criminal investigation. He cannot, for that reason, be nominating anyone. Anyway, so call, even if you don't live in those states, and certainly if you do, call them and let them know your thoughts.
Give that number one more time.
202-224-3121.
Thank you. And also another thing we can do along those lines, ProPublica published an article mapping the detention centers across the country. You can Google it. It's, if you Google immigrant children shelter map, you can click on a link and you'll see exactly the shelters that are around you. They want, if you have any information, if you happen to work there, you can fill out very easily some info. And if you're afraid to do that, you can use the app WhatsApp or Signal and send a message to the number that's there, which I'm not going to bother you with right now, but well, I will. 347-244-2134, in case it's just easier for people. Which leads to an event going on around the country and here in Charlottesville, which is a rally to oppose the administration's inhumane immigration policies. The local event is at 11 a.m. here at the Albemarle County Building at Preston and McIntyre. What we are going to demand is an end to the separation indefinite detention of immigrant families at the border, reject the racism and xenophobia being spread by Trump and his local allies like Corey Stewart, and show solidarity with immigrants in our own community who are affected by divisive immigration policies. That's today at 11 and all around the world, I believe, too.
Yeah, well, they also want to abolish ICE. And, there's, I believe, at least 750 protests in all 50 states in little nooks and crannies, too. It's not just the big cities. They're all over, just like with the Women's March, familiesbelongtogether.org. If you're, you know, if you have time, to go, they're all listed there.
Yes, and there are plenty of things to do if you just can't, for one reason or another,
yes,
to get involved, as
course.
We've said.
And it's hardly just today.
Yes, and today's show, we're going to be talking about that in depth with Jim Cohen. But first, our first guest is Matt Rohde, the bringer of donuts. He is the owner of Carpe Donut, and he's created Donut Coin, a donut-backed currency. He's here to break down this mysterious cryptocurrency, explain Bitcoin, blockchain, and all matters crypto. Welcome to the show, Matt.
Well, good morning, Ellen. Hi, Nancy. How are you?
Hey.
She's good. So, what I heard someone say recently in this very studio, they said, I'm terrified about this notion of currency online. What is the first thing that we need to know to understand it? Where would you start for people who are terrified and who just don't know what it is?
That's perfectly
right. In fairness, everything is making us terrified, so no disparaging of cryptocurrency, please. Sorry.
Well, I would definitely say it's very interesting and worth learning about. You don't need to put dollars into it to get participatory and sort of start wrapping your mind around it a little bit. I understand the concern. There's a lot of history within blockchain, within cryptocurrencies, of criminality, money laundering, offshore accounts. It's all the scariest parts of capitalism kind of rolled into one. At the same time, it holds a lot of promise to be able to do many of the things we must do in a commerce-based society, to connect people, to do trade, to, you know, the technology behind it is fascinating, and what it can do, we're only kind of beginning to understand. There's a lot of elements about voting. There's a lot of elements about identity verification online, and these are big problems that potentially we get to solve with this technology.
But why is it good? Why should we be paying attention to it, considering we have currency now? What is the benefit of okay, go ahead.
So there's a bunch of benefits potentially to it, and many of those are already starting to unfold. I guess the first reason we want to pay attention to it is $1 trillion of the world economy is now starting to be transacted within these cryptocurrency models. There's ways it operates like money. There's ways it operates like a capital market, like a stock market. There's ways that it operates as validation of identity and these other elements. You know, it's big and it's complicated. It inherently does have some value. And the way we can kind of see that is it's moving along even despite some of those negatives that we talked about earlier and some of the limits of it's hard to wrap one's head around.
So how would you help us do that from the very beginning?
Sure. Well, maybe let me tell you a little bit how I got involved. It, when you were saying all those nice things about me before, it was funny for me to hear those. A year ago, I couldn't have explained any of this. So let me start by saying I think a reasonably attentive person can start to wrap their mind around these, how this works and what it might potentially do fairly quickly. My son, who's 21, is my gateway into understanding this. He started paying me his cell phone bill because I was still giving him a cell phone in cryptocurrencies. And all of a sudden, I had a little stake in the game and I needed to figure out, how do I transfer these? How do I turn them into dollars? What is this worth? While I was figuring it out, it took me about 3 or 4 months to get a time together with him to say, hey, let's set up my wallet. Let's figure this stuff out. My $300 had appreciated to about $1,600 worth of cryptocurrencies, Ethereum, Bitcoin, Litecoin, etc. That will get anybody's attention. So once you realize that was me participating unwittingly in the way that cryptocurrencies act like capital markets or stock markets. So we were in this really big run, which, you know, has some elements of a bubble to it, but lots of these basic cryptocurrencies that have been around for 10 years suddenly had a 100-fold increase in value in a pretty short period of time. That's probably not where this is all going to land in the long run, but it's what does happen as new capital markets emerge.
Is it, would you say, probably simplifying this, but is it better than using U.S. currency or just another option?
Nancy, that's an absolutely political question.
Oh, shut up.
So from my perspective, from my political perspective or social perspective, yes, it's better. And let me maybe unpack that just a little bit. Every transaction that you ever participate in, when you go to buy a donut, for instance, we're exchanging some kind of currency. Money's been around for 4,000 years, something like that. And when we do that, we're engaging in kind of a symbolic exchange. That dollar bill is worth something because we all agree that it's worth something. When we do that within the system of dollars or Deutschmarks or I guess now euros, whatever, there's a what's called a trusted third party. So a trusted third party, for example, would be Bank of America or the Visa network or any of the traditional banking elements. That's great. It works really well. We see that, you know, it won World War II. It's whatever. What we're talking about within cryptocurrencies is the first genuinely viable alternative in some context to using that trusted third party system. I don't like trusted third parties because I believe we put too much power in the hands of bankers. Now, that's a crazy thing to say. That's just my personal opinion. What's interesting about these blockchain technologies is there's no trusted third party. It's the math. You simply have an algorithmic register or ledger of everybody who's ever exchanged these little parts of a Bitcoin, and everybody can look at it. It's open source, like Linux is to Microsoft, blockchain is to the United States dollar. So what we're starting to talk about is a consensus-built idea of money or a consensus-built idea of a capital market, like a stock market. I'm proposing something that's going to look a little bit more like a corporate bond within the crypto. That's getting ahead of ourselves. But why would we want to do this? I think alternatives to trusting Bank of America are worth investing in and investigating.
Yeah, I would second that. So you talked about blockchain, which is the spreadsheet or the ledger.
Right.
Is that correct?
That's the technology that sits underneath the idea of any of these cryptocurrencies or any of these different elements that we're specifically kind of interested in. People will usually bump into Bitcoin first. It was the first big adopted version of a cryptocurrency, the first version of blockchain that people saw. There has been an unbelievable, amazing proliferation of hundreds of different projects centered around this blockchain technology. And all it is a public list of everybody who's ever traded these back and forth. Every time you want to go and spend or buy a Bitcoin from somebody, everybody who owns that Bitcoin gives up a little computing power to double check, hey, do we all agree that this fraction of a Bitcoin used to be owned by Steve and now it's owned by Mary and then she's going to give it to Larry and this is going to be that record is everybody's security. And that record, by the way, is both open and completely encrypted. So that's where my technical expertise of this probably like hits a brick wall. But I do understand that for 10 years since the Bitcoin was introduced in the mining process, and we can talk about mining and all that, everyone's been essentially invited to crack the code of its encryption and get millions and millions of dollars for free. And no one's been able to do it. And to me, that's a kind of security that is in some ways more impressive than a Fort Knox. Like if you're opening up the source and saying, anybody crack our mathematics and then you can have all the money, and nobody comes and takes all the money away, that's a great indication that the encryption is really strong and working really well.
Just to follow up on that. So, I mean, that's kind of reassuring, but then I'd like to know why it's so secure. What makes it so secure so that one day someone isn't going to just break into it?
It goes back to, and again, this is outside of my technical expertise, mm-hmm. but it's well within my area of social interest. It's like, this is what I find fascinating about it. The founder, the inventor of Bitcoin was a person named Satoshi Nakamoto, who is not a real person by anybody's measure. So this is a pseudonym or a nom de guerre or something. Maybe it was a committee. Maybe it was Elon Musk. Maybe it was a time-traveling Nikola Tesla. Maybe it was a space alien. I don't know, but it's really complicated math, and it is brilliant and genius level. And so there is this aspect where it's kind of cloaked in a little bit of mystery. So as we get to more modern blockchains, they don't have all that same cachet. People are building off of this basic idea and saying, oh, I see, this really works. And then you get Ethereum or you get Litecoin. These are projects that have real-world companies and real-world individuals kind of tied in behind them. But Bitcoin just sort of appeared, and everybody had to figure out what to make of it. And I think that was really fascinating.
Like the Banksy of cryptocurrency.
Like the Banksy of cryptocurrency. Exactly right. The 1/100th of a Bitcoin is known as a Satoshi, and in honor of this mystery person who created this really elegant, cohesive, still secure version of blockchain technology and just kind of introduced it to everybody.
This language is almost the best part. I know it's not really why you're here, but all of these words are really incredible. And I was wondering, what is involved with creating a cryptocurrency?
Well, and I think Ellen may give me a little bit too much credit. What I've proposed is a crypto project. I would like to use an existing cryptocurrency, and we're going to put our stamp on it. We'll use a version of Ethereum, which is called an ERC-20 token.
Are you going to explain what that is?
I will. So Ethereum is one of these blockchain cryptocurrencies, right? And we're going to take a version of that, and we're going to call it a donut coin. It will operate just like Ethereum. Ethereum is probably the second most used and popular cryptocurrency. One thing that's very nice about it is we've mentioned that the blockchain is a ledger. It's a list of all the people who've ever used the coin. Well, that's a computer program, and the Ethereum token added a little bit more complexity to that and said, it's actually a whole computer program. You can write a little program with it. You can do stuff with it if you want to. And one of the things you can do with it is you can write a smart contract. You can write a contract. You're going to get these 20 Ethereum dollars, Ethereum tokens, but only after you provide the service, only after you give us the goods, whatever it might be. So it has to be validated to be for the contract to be completed. This has amazing implications in the realm of places like real estate. We spend a ton of money doing things like escrows for real estate transactions, doing things like just holding contracts very short term to make transactions go smoothly internationally. Well, Ethereum has the specific capacity built in to implement contracts in the blockchain. So we're going to look at that for our company, for Carpe Donut. I happen to have the ability to make, I don't know, 1 million donuts and ship them anywhere in the country via Amazon.com. So I can say, I'm going to issue a crypto token, and whatever else happens in the economy, in the world, and whatever, I will always give you 2 dozen donuts shipped to your door if you give me back this token. Well, that will set the value of the token at about $40, which is what it costs to get my donuts on Amazon. And that should essentially be like a corporate bond. It would be a way for Carpe Donut to raise a lot of money for our expansions and our refinancing on all the things we need to do in the corporate world. But we will be issuing a little corporate bond via the crypto markets. And that would have been something that's totally beyond the reach of a company my size to interest, I don't know, Goldman Sachs in issuing us a corporate bond. That's not going to happen anytime soon.
We're going to go to a hard break. Fascinating discussion with Matt Rohde about this mysterious, elegant, cohesive consensus-built idea of money. We'll be right back with more Apropos of Something. Also, Jim Cohn to talk about the immigrant crisis, the effects on the children's brains. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Apropos of Something. We're on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're talking with Matt Rohde about Bitcoin and cryptocurrency. So we're going to talk a little bit more about Donut Coin, your project, but tell us, if somebody wanted to get involved, where do they go? How do they do it?
Sure. Some of it is the real nuts and bolts of how do you turn things into dollars and to turn dollars back into crypto coins. How, you know, you can think of it in terms of investing. Part of this is a challenge of language and people catching up with the technology. In America, the SEC has weighed in with some very specific, very conservative guidelines about anything that looks like an investment vehicle or an instrument needs to be treated like an investment instrument, like a security. Right now, the easiest and safest and, you know, pretty much the only within America, the rules in the American economic system is to use a company called Coinbase. Coinbase is a subsidiary of Goldman Sachs Industries. So you know that they're tied in with the Treasury Department. Everybody knows what's happening. It's all on the up and up. They will transfer your Bitcoin, Ethereum, Litecoin, et cetera, into dollars and vice versa. There are hundreds of some more safe, some less safe exchanges online. Once you are in this crypto space, it's real easy to turn a Litecoin into some Ethereum or any of these back into Bitcoin. That happens within online spaces. And what I would really recommend if people are interested in doing this is find somebody under 25 who already knows about it. Set up a couple wallets. These are digital repositories to keep all of your information safe. I had a great guide. My son Finn did a fantastic job of walking me through the initial stages so that I could start to move these around. And I now take 4 of these cryptocurrencies for donuts at the farmer's market every Saturday. Oh, wow. I'm set up to do that on my phone, on my tablet. People can come up and flash a QR code. I'll tell them, you know, I'll set up a QR code for the size of their order. The transaction takes about 30 seconds.
Wow. And you had mentioned sevilleblockchain.org as a place to also get more information.
You know, I really am. I've got a view on this that's kind of like an excited newbie. I really get it, and I get excited about it. I'm trying to develop a project around it. But there are some very, very experienced people at sevilleblockchain.org. There is a monthly meetup that has been hosted at the Studio X over at the X Art Park on the first Tuesday of the month. We'll resume those in September. That website is a great resource, and there's a lot of folks who've been involved in organizing that group.
And just a quick about that, can people go to that website if they're not from Sevil and learn?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, some of our previous conversations get archived, just a general overview.
And the sustainable food aspect, you know, the donuts, why does that lend itself to cryptocurrency?
Well, I don't know that it lends itself more than any other industry. In fact, we've got perishable food. We're shipping it real fast overnight. We're not necessarily a poster child for how to, you know, why people would need to move money around on the internet. I think this cryptocurrency started as the money of the internet. People wanted a really fungible, secure, easy way to move large quantities of money or value around in an anonymous and instantaneous way. And it's been doing that and is getting better at that over time. I looked at it from a different perspective. I've had a hard time for 11 years running this company being properly bankable because the choices I make to make organic food at the scale I operate, it's not very interesting to the conventional corporate banking system. I'm not very bankable. I'm not as bad as some folks are. There are people in the world who are way worse off than me. As we start talking about the promise for the future, think about how many people in the third world don't have any access to banking services at all. How much they pay to remit money back to Central America or to remit money back to India or wherever it might be. So there's some real exciting promises for democratization of access to capital within this. For me, I look at organic food as a mission for me and for my company. And if this is a potential pathway to overcome our challenges of not being as bankable as we need to be, to grow and to expand and to do the things we want to do, then to me, that's very exciting.
And I missed, actually, I'm not sure you did say this, Matt, but on your donut website or even at the store, can you use Bitcoin, your donut coin only, or is that the way it works?
That's a great question, Nancy. Actually, no, I'm not yet set up to issue donut coin tokens.
Okay.
If you go to donutcoin.io, and .io is a web address that is all things crypto. So everything in the crypto world and the blockchain world seems to like .io as the suffix. Donutcoin.io is a white paper. It's a proposal for how we would develop this. I mean, I'm going to use a term that the SEC would come down on me like a ton of bricks. We'll call it like a corporate bond. We'd like to issue tokens and be willing to redeem them forever for donuts. And that by itself is something that nobody in the space is really doing right now. So, you know, we want to set this whole program up not to raise money. We'd like to raise other cryptos. We'd like to raise Ethereum and then get the project off the ground. I've got some people ready to go in terms of issuing the token, and they'll be happy to be paid in Ethereum as well. But right now, I can't accept any donut coins because they haven't been issued yet. It's more of a project we'd like to put together. I am willing to accept Bitcoin, Litecoin, Ethereum, or Bitcoin Cash in exchange for my donuts anytime, any place.
So, if someone wanted to invest or do what you said and set up a wallet, what is the worst? What should they be nervous about? And is just doing something that minimal really a danger in any way? And what's the worst thing that could happen?
I guess the worst thing that could happen is you would set up a wallet somewhere and then someone else would get access to it and take away your cryptocurrencies. Mm-hmm. As long as you're never putting more monies into this process, excuse me, then you're ready to lose. Mm-hmm. You can learn a lot by moving small amounts of these things around and trying to transfer them. There are a few other interesting places where you can spend them. You can spend them to pay your cable bill for some people in the country. Different dish networks and such have started accepting these. There's a few places on the internet where you can buy gift cards to Amazon or Bed Bath & Beyond or whatever that might be. Mm-hmm. So there's some interesting ways that people are using these to connect back into the mainstream economy.
And how do you ensure, or how does one ensure, that you've released a successful token?
Well, from my perspective, I look at, as I'm looking at different tokens and considering them, first of all, what do people want to do with the token? Right now, I look at Bitcoin as a great place to just park some of the value that you want to save. It seems to be a pretty good long-term place to hold value. I like Ethereum for transactions, particularly any transaction that needs a contract behind it. I've liked Litecoin because it's real fast. So if somebody's going to issue a token, well, what is it trying to do? What is it purporting to add some value in the world? And then I would ask what the technology is. Is it an open source technology like Ethereum where everyone gets to look at what you're doing? Or is this a private blockchain company that maybe can issue as many tokens as they want to? We already have an entity like that. We call it the Federal Reserve. So there's no reason to create that within the blockchain world. And I think that over the next probably 10 years, we're going to see new innovative ideas coming forward. There's going to be some voting ones. There's going to be some identity verification ones. There's going to be stuff we haven't even thought of yet. And then there'll probably be a lot of them that aren't really worth spending much time on at all. They're Ponzi schemes. They're get rich quick schemes. It's a Nigerian prince, and you know he just wants you to use your bank account for a minute. So there's some of that within the world, this world as well. I think if you stick to the big four or five cryptocurrencies, I think if you stay on very reputable sites, you use Coinbase for now because that's what the government is supporting and is open to. And pay your taxes on these transactions. That's if you're doing all those things, then I think you can learn a lot about this in a pretty short period of time.
You know, the more you talk about it, the more it really does, which is probably what you're trying to say, but it really is like banking. I mean, when we all go bank online, et cetera, how often do we hear there's been a breach, there's been, data, things that have been released because someone hacked in? I mean, the dangers... It's not like regular traditional banking is rock solid and that you have already established that so far anyway, no one has broken into this cryptocurrency code, So you have, there is like a good argument. Anyway, I don't mean to sound like I get to decide. It is like you have standing to push this.
Sure, and $1 trillion worth of the world's money has migrated over here because they trust it, at least proportionally, alongside these traditional trusted third parties. And it's funny, when we mention them out loud, when I say Goldman Sachs or I say Bank of America or Chase or Morgan Stanley, these aren't names that create a warm, fuzzy feeling for most people. Most people see those as pretty rapacious, manipulative entities. So the bar is not set that high for cryptocurrency to be able to do a better job at providing some of these basic services, particularly for people who cannot go to the banking system for good outcomes.
I want to talk about your business a little bit with the donuts, actually the dough and the flour. But is there anything that you feel like we've left out?
Sure. No. This, to me, getting to explain it as we pull each piece out is the best way for me to try to think about it, because I have been trying to do every little element of this short of actually launching my own currency. So I'm kind of gearing up as well. So I really appreciate the chance to think about it this way.
Okay. Tell us something fascinating about your donut business.
Donut business. Well, we're going to hit 11 years.
Wow.
Next
yes.
week.
It's
so,
very beloved here in Charlottesville.
The idea that we could have managed to survive this long without good access to capital. We kind of bootstrapped it from our home equity line and our credit cards and just a lot of scrapping for 11 years and really trying to stay very true. This year, we will go to 100% organic ingredients. Mm. That's the exciting thing for me right now. We got organic confectioner sugar so we could do glazes last year. One of my big suppliers suddenly had it available. I am honing in on organic oils and organic cider, and those are the last two that I've been doing, either local or unhydrogenated, whatever I could do, but we want to go to 100% organic mm-hmm. this year.
What is your most popular flavor, sir?
I think the original cinnamon sugar is still the most popular, but if you ask anybody under the age of 8, it would be the pink one with the sprinkles, which is organic blueberry and natural sprinkles without any, only vegetable colors. I'm playing around with all organic empanadas right now on the sly. So
great. We're
going to probably have those available for some of our catering work soon.
Cannot wait for that. Thank you so much for being here, Matt Rohde.
Yes.
If you want to learn more about cyber cryptocurrency, go to cvilleblockchain.org.
Thank you all so much for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being here. I know you may have to go back to the hot market. So
yeah.
Oh, I want to take your picture. So Nancy, do a little talking. Give us our news of note.
I shall do that. Okay, so in lieu of our next guest, my news of note is that in order to greatly reduce the number of refugees allowed into the U.S., this administration has decided to manipulate a report from their own DHHS, Health and Human Services Department. It had showed that refugees brought in $63 billion more in government revenues over the past decade than the refugees cost, but instead of reporting this as truth, the White House killed their department's own findings report and issued alternate facts, making it appear that the refugees are only a tremendous burden to our economy. And it has been proven that they're a major benefit. They pay more in taxes than they consume in public benefits. They fill jobs and service industries that others will not. And if anyone is a burden to the economy, it is this administration who is, which aren't, you know, who, whatever it is, whatever the correct pronoun is, they're, the cost of holding migrant children separated from their parents in these tent cities is costing $775 per person per night with, for a 400-bed temporary structure for 1 month at capacity. That's $5 million, and most kids, separated kids, are in them for nearly 2 months. They're asking the Pentagon to spend $1 billion to build militarized tent cities to detain as many as 119,000 people. Aside from the military bases where they're going to put up 20,000 kids. Anyway, it's just, it's so obvious to everyone why they're doing this. It has nothing to do with the burden that they place on the economy. That is my news of note. I hope that picture is taken, Ellen.
Yes.
What do you got?
We took the picture. So I just want to get right to talk to the expert, Jim Cohn. He is an associate professor of clinical psychology and director of the Virginia Affective Neuroscience Laboratory at the University of Virginia. He studies how the brain transforms social connection into better mental and physical health. We're going to talk with him about the very specific effects the administration's policies are having on children and families separated at the border. Cohn has been researching the crisis through his podcast, Circle of Willis. And this month, his op-ed entitled "The Trump Administration is Committing Violence Against Children" appeared in the Washington Post. We're also going to talk about hopefully something hopeful. He has a new project to help reunite families. Welcome back to the show, Jim.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Yes. So, your op-ed was titled, as I said, that the administration is committing violence against children. How are they doing so?
Yeah. You know, first of all, I just want to say that I think that anyone, whether you voted for Trump, whether you voted for Clinton, whatever your political persuasion is in this country, if we were observing border agents physically assaulting young children, no one would stand for the policy that we're seeing being implemented, that we have seen implemented. Nobody would have allowed that to continue. I have to believe that. I do believe that. The issue is most of us, many of us, don't understand that just the act of separating those children from their families does violence to their nervous systems and ultimately to their bodies. And sort of understanding how that happens is, sadly, been the domain of a group of relatively unknown academics, you know, studying the nature of child relationships to their parents and the developing nervous system in that context. So I'm trying to get the word out about what happens, mm-hmm. And it all starts with something that we can all intuit, which is that when you separate a kid from their families, from their parents in particular, they're really freaked out. I don't know how many of you have heard the ProPublica recording of children crying and screaming at one of the detention facilities. I listened to the whole thing. It's about 7 minutes. It's excruciating, and it's intended to be excruciating. And this is one of the things that starts, this is one of the entry points to understanding what's going on with these children. Children are in such distress in order to, as one of my colleagues, Megan Gunner at the University of Minnesota, put it, to break their parents' hearts. That's the purpose, because here's the thing. Over evolutionary time, if you were a kid that got separated from your parents, you were going to die. Now, that may not be as true today. We have other kinds of services in place. But the deep, old evolutionary parts of your brain have no idea about that. They're still operating on the assumption that if you don't have your parents around, you're going to die. And it's a good assumption. I mean, in some ways, even today, it's a good assumption. So that's why you have that massive level of distress. And by the way, if we have time, we'll talk about what's happening with the parents as well, because the parents are also being tortured, really, by this separation. The thing is that distress is so intense that it causes a sort of physical cascade in your body of stress responding. And it includes things like a saturation of stress hormones that prepare you for more danger, right? Prepare you that pumps glucose into your bloodstream, gets you hyper aware and hyper alert for potential dangers. And that's all excellent if there's an actual stress that's happening and you have to deal with it. But of course, these kids are separated from their parents for a long period of time. And so what happens is this. That level of distress can't be sustained for too long. It's just too painful. It just costs too much energy in the body and the brain to do that. And so what happens next is these kids face a little bit of a decision. And not a little bit of it. It's a very weighty decision. And the decision is this. Do I continue to scream and cry to be reunited with my parents at incredible cost to my body right now and through searing emotional pain? Or do I, in a sense, assume that my parents are gone and stop the screaming and invest my resources elsewhere, which is to assume that I'm going to have to do whatever I have to do alone? And that decision changes the way that your brain develops, changes the way that your body develops. It changes your future life in terms of how you can expect to be sick, and it may even shorten your lifespan.
We're talking with Jim Cohn about the effects of this separation of families and children at the border. He has termed it a moral four-alarm fire. We couldn't agree more. We'll be right back to discuss this and hopefully what we can do, what can be done about it. We'll be right back with Apropos of Something. Welcome back to Apropos of Something. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. So, Jim, you were talking about what happens when the kids cry and then decisions they have to make and the sort of numbing out. Continue with what you were saying.
Yeah, well, so what happens is, if a kid has been separated from their parents for a long period of time, at some point they have to just assume that the parent's not coming back. And that assumption creates a whole cascade of sort of reorientations for the kid's developing nervous system, because you have to assume as a child that the world is much scarier, much more dangerous than you thought it was before. And that decision really causes you to sort of, we think of it as sort of rebudgeting the resources you have available in your body. And here's what that looks like. From the outside, it might look like the kid is in some ways even better behaved at times, because they're just going to numb out, as you said. They're going to be often just sort of sitting there. But what's going on under the hood is they're assuming that they could be killed or harmed at any moment. So they increase their level of threat vigilance in their mind, and they increase their sort of level of reactivity to even small, slightly stressful events. And so their body's constantly going through these sort of high level stress responses. But one of the other things that's happening, and this might be obvious or seem intuitive to some people, is that one of the things about humans is that we take a long time to develop. Under normal circumstances, humans, more than almost any other animal, we take years, decades to really develop into full adults. And the reason that we take so long is that we have parents. We have adults who are competent, who are loving, who are trustworthy, to sort of scaffold us and shepherd us through that slow, long development. And that slow development has a specific function, which is to give us all kinds of tools to use once we reach adulthood that other animals don't get to use. Well, if those parents aren't there, the brain has a backup system. And that backup system is to mature more quickly, to create a sort of a fast track to adulthood, so that you, on the assumption that you're not going to have someone there to have your back if something goes wrong. And what this means is your flexibility in coping with the world has to be suppressed, because you don't have time to develop all of these behavioral repertoires, these alternative ways to cope with your own emotions or deal with adversity. You come up with sort of quick, easy algorithms, right? And those algorithms are usually the kind that cause you to get under the table if a loud noise happens, rather than sort of wonder, what was that loud noise? Was that a gunshot? That's what you're going to do if you've had time to be flexible. But if you haven't had time, you're going to assume the worst, right? And you can imagine under, warlike conditions and really harsh situations, that would be really valuable. And in fact, it is. It saves you. But if you're going to have to go to school, if you're going to have to sort of function in normal society, that's gonna make it harder for you to do that, because you're going to be constantly having these strong stress reactions and potentially making some pretty poor decisions along the way. So all of this has negative, destructive health outcomes, can really harm you. I can lay that out if you want. There's really two major trajectories that I'm trying to get people to understand here. And one of them has to do with your behavior. If you have had to mature more quickly, if you have to depend on rapid fire decisions, one of the things that we know is the result of that is that you're going to make more risky decisions. So you might engage in more risky sex, for example, as you go through adolescence. You might make more decisions that are based on short-term gains rather than long-term gains. So why do I have to read this textbook at school? It's not doing anything for me. I have to, you know, worry about where I'm going to get my next meal, for example, or how I'm going to make a little cash right now, or whatever it is. So those decisions accumulate, and they result often in what we call poor health behaviors. You're more likely to self-medicate with like drugs or alcohol. You're less likely to invest time in long-term goals like a college degree, an advanced degree, you know, investing money. Any of those things are less likely to happen because you're more focused on short-term goals. And this ultimately can hurt your health. But there's another trajectory, too, that sort of works in parallel when you've had the kind of traumatic experience that these kids are going through right now at the border. And that is, your body assumes not only dangers from outside, like other people are going to be mean to you or they're not going to watch out for you, but in fact that you might succumb to an infection. So your body has this sort of constant low-grade inflammatory response, as if you're constantly fighting an infection, and it's sort of a way to sort of front-load defense against all kinds of invaders. And what this does is it weathers your body. It just sort of breaks your body down. It causes your body to age prematurely all throughout the rest of your life, and it can in fact manifest in another way. So if we talked about the example of a loud noise putting you under the table, well, let's say it's not even that loud a noise. Someone dropped their pen on the table. Sometimes kids who have these kinds of traumatic experiences in their past will have an exaggerated threat response even to that. And when that happens over and over again, day after day, over months and years and decades, that weathering is also accelerated. You have this constant stress on your cardiovascular system. Your blood vessels become more inflexible and rigid. You become more at risk for all kinds of cardiovascular disease. And all of this, you put the bad health decisions and health behaviors together with the impact on the cardiovascular system and the weathering on your body from this constant inflammation, and you die earlier. And we know that this happens too.
Yeah, I mean, they're already coming from such unimaginable terror. You know, they're in a surrounding that's incredibly hostile, and they can't speak the language for the most part. I get that there are people there that speak both languages, but all of that on top, at this point, I mean, is it so horrific that those factors actually cannot even make it worse, or do those factors actually even make it worse?
Oh, they make it much worse. What we're talking about here is trauma added to trauma. And one of the things, though, that just to get us back, one of the things that I study in my own personal research is the effect that proximity to people that we know and trust and love has on our stress response. So here's the thing about those traumas that they're fleeing. They may be fleeing violence in, you know, their home country, wherever that is. They may have experienced traumas trying to get to the border through Mexico, however that occurred. But one of the things that nature has provided all of those kids is the sort of the best stress buffering system it could come up with. And that is proximity to their parents. There's nothing that's going to buffer the effect of those previous traumas better, more effectively than proximity to their primary caregivers, right? And so what's happened is, in the context of those previous traumas, this policy of separating kids from their parents has removed from those children the most effective potential method through which they can cope with those traumas. So it's not only that you are adding a new trauma to them, but you're also removing from them their most effective coping structure, their most effective way of buffering the traumas that have already occurred.
And that's something that the court has known. I mean, that we always hear it's going to be hard to separate your child just in normal, quote unquote, circumstances in this country. The court usually decides to keep a child with their parent.
Yeah. I mean, there's lots of research going back decades about the effects of separations of children and from their primary families, their parents. The difference often is that in all of the studies that have been done, all the examples, World War II, when kids in London were separated from their families during the bombings that were going on, all of those examples, time and time again, the kids are at least usually going to someone they know. They're going to someone they know. There's this background assumption of reunion at some point. There's a lot of communication going back and forth. There's basically a lot more knowledge that there's a tether to that. Those parents, even that assumption is not happening here. Of course, the children are put in congregate care facilities. We call them. This is basically orphanages. These detention centers that have been set up. They're all over the country, so they're often hundreds, maybe thousands of miles now from their parents. They don't even know where their parents are. Incredibly. Oftentimes, the various organizations and agencies that are tasked with both the separation and the housing and detention centers of these children haven't kept track of where their parents are. So this is why I call it that four-alarm moral fire. We have created a perfect storm for these children right at the point when their nervous systems are developing assumptions about the conditions they can expect for the rest of their lives.
So, Jim, can you tell us about your project before we run out of time?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, this is just at the very beginning stages. I haven't set it up. There's a group of lawyers out in Boston that are working to sort of understand all of the legal channels that need to be in place in order to get, at the very least, these children out of detention centers, these congregate care facilities, and with loving families, right? So this is the bare minimum. This is something we have to really consider at this point. And I hope, and by the way, if there's any conservatives listening, I doubt it, but this is not a partisan kind of thing. I think the Trump administration would love to do this, frankly, at this point, if they could. But we need more buy-in from the public. We need to get these kids out of detention centers and with people who can provide more stable, grounded, loving, affectionate situations, and also serve as advocates for those children as they pursue reunion with their parents. Right now, the system is utterly overwhelmed. But it's not just about distributing the effort of reunifying these kids with their parents. It's also about the kind of care that these children can receive. In congregate care facilities, in these detention centers, you've got constant turnover of workers. The workers are overwhelmed by all the kids. These kids cannot get their needs met. And their needs include things like not just, medical care, clothing, shelter, but touch, affection, looking them right in the eye and in the face and asking them how they're feeling and attending to their experience. These things matter hugely for their physical and mental health for the rest of their lives. And these are things that we can all do as a community to try and help them out.
So we'll list a website or two on our website, 947wpvc.org, that you can give me later, and people can go there. And also, you have your podcast. Perhaps there's resources there, Circle of Willis.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much, Jim. It was really important, the work that you're doing, and thanks for sharing that with us.
Thank you for having me on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, Nancy.
I'm just going to go on record and say I don't believe this White House does care, but I respect Jim's opinion, but I don't think they do. Okay, so let's pivot, as they say in the political.
Okay, this is my cue. Hold on. Time for the palate cleanser.
Not a moment too soon, in my opinion. Did you want to go first? I don't even know. Sorry. You want to go first?
No, you go first.
All right. Okay. Here's what a day at the beach, since it is getting close to a holiday, maybe the last one. Here's what a day at the beach literally looked like for women in the 1700s. Your fashion option was a bathing gown, a double suit, their idea of a two-piece, which was made of wool. It went from shoulder to knee, plus a set of trousers with leggings down to the ankles. And then in the 1800s, this unshapely silhouette became a one-piece, a loose, ankle-length, full-sleeve dress made of up to 9 yards of wool or flannel. Fabrics that were not, of course, to be transparent. They actually stitched weights into the seams so that the hems would not rise up in the water. Modesty and decency were very on trend, and I would say so was sinking if they're putting weights in these things. Anyway, what do you got?
You're done. Okay, sorry. I was caught off guard trying to do something over here with my dials. Okay, so the origin of the phrase dollars to donuts. This is from phrases.org.uk. Dollars to donuts is one of several phrases using dollars, like dollars to buttons and dollars to cobwebs, which date from 1884 and 1904, respectively, from the Boston Herald, etc. Buttons and cobwebs were presumably chosen for their obvious lack of value, but the expressions failed to catch on because they lacked the perky alliteration of dollars to donuts. So this
is all about the alliteration.
I know it is. And this is our time to say no one has to do everything, but everyone must do something. There is a rally going on in Charlottesville. Check Facebook, Google it, do something, get people out to vote. Find one person who didn't vote the last election. We have to do this. Our democracy is at stake. And our music is by Springtide. Thanks for being here, Nance.
Yes. Thank you, Ellen.
Thanks for listening to Apropos of Something this morning on 94.7 WPBC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Show and host Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence each Saturday at 10 for Apropos of Something. Brought to you by the Beckham Team and Keller Williams. Show archive can be found at SeavillePodcast.com.